The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. England 1, Croatia 0. Raheem Sterling's second half strike means England win their opening game in a European Championships for the first time ever. And England have never not won the Euros when they've won their first game. Ergo, it's coming home. Calvin Phillips excels in midfield. Tyrone Mings excellent in a back four with two right backs. The clamour for Jack Grealish unheard. We'll analyse it all. Elsewhere, game of the tournament so far as the Netherlands beat Ukraine 3-2. And Goran Pandev scores for North Macedonia. But it's not enough as David Alaba leads Austria to victory. And Marko Arnautovic is very angry about the whole thing. We'll have the latest on Christian Eriksen, answer your questions, read some quite self-indulgent complimentary messages. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Paul McInnes, how are you doing?
I'm very good, Max. How are you?
Is that a Steven Gerrard 2010 England shirt?
Yeah, I can't be sure. I can't even remember whether it's 2006 or 2010. It's one of the two.
Good to represent. Jonathan Wilson, hello.
All right, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. And Barney Ronnie, welcome to the pod.
Hello.
Rosser says, what's the biggest number on the hubris meter? I think 14. Dial it right up. Mark says, what's the best parade route for the trophy? Just London or visiting a few major cities? Martin says, which font does Barry think would best suit the word England when it's put on the trophy at the end of the tournament? Is he a Times New Roman guy? And Justin said, if anything, have England started the tournament too well? Barney, you were there. How was it?
Yeah, it was good. They were good, I thought. I mean, it was kind of interesting. Wembley was great. I think you were in the vicinity today, is that right?
I was at Wembley Box Park, ready to throw my pint around. But I left before the game and sat and watched it in my living room.
Well, I thought, yeah, I mean, everybody looked a little bit startled by all the sun and the light and stuff. It was kind of nice. And then I think it's a fairly low bar, but that's probably England's best 90 minutes victory at a tournament since 2002. They just beat the World Cup finalists in their opening group. Fair enough, Croatia are not what they were, but they're not terrible. And England didn't really allow them to look particularly good. I thought they're pretty dismal, actually. And the three tricky selections that people were immediately sort of spurting their mug of coffee out as soon as they saw the selection drop on social media and quote tweeting saying OMG, you know, waistcoat melt and that kind of thing. Trippier looked like a really sensible defensive selection, and they kept a clean sheet. And the double midfield pivot, the allegedly average Phillips, played brilliantly, I thought, and he made the goal. And of course, Raheem Sterling finally scored, although he missed a lot as well. But he just kept running and kept going. And tactically, it was a really sound selection. It was a kind of Timo Werner kind of selection in that if you take Sterling's movement and pace and drive out of that team, they would look a little bit one-paced, I think. But no, they did really well. It was a really good win. And Gareth is vindicated.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was on the radio when the news of the 11 filtered through, and the texts and the tweets were very angry, certainly about not playing a left back at left back. Southgate out was trending before the game. AMTT says, hi Max, Gareth won without doing the specific thing I, an experienced football manager, wanted him to do. Should I be annoyed? Neil, how will Southgate ultimately be judged, by results or by who he picks at left back? Paul, I was surprised. I mean, I was surprised, given there are two very good left backs in the squad, that he went with a right back at left back.
Yeah, well, I've been surprised at how little people have talked about Trippier as an England player, full stop. He never really got picked in anybody's best 11s, at right back. And, there are reasons for that. I can understand it. But A, Southgate obviously trusts him, and Southgate, if he trusts you, he'd stick with you. He's loyal. And that's one of the, I think one of the psychological aspects to his squad development that is key for him. It's like, I'll trust you, you give me back. Two, he's not the only manager who's trusted him. He was trusted by Pochettino heavily. He's been trusted by Simeone heavily. So the guy's got something about him. And, he was probably, England's best player at the World Cup in 2018. So he's proven it at the tournament. So it surprised me how low down the rankings he came for a lot of people. I would have put Shaw in at left back because he's had such a great season, and defensively, well, I think you can ask questions about Chilwell. Shaw, you know, has been very robust in that regard for United this year.
He won't let you down.
No, I don't think so. And he's got the recovery pace as well. And sorry, am I missing out on an in-joke there? But
it was a bad deodorant-based joke.
Oh,
actually,
sure,
but it's okay.
Sure it was. But yeah, you know, blah blah blah. He's done so. You could, but I don't think Trippier's played the last two warm-up games in that position. So he was obviously thinking about it. Didn't let anybody down in those games. And while I think there's question marks you could say about if you wanted him to be playing a more aggressive attacking role, there's limitations to that when he's playing on his weaker foot. That wasn't really what he was supposed to be doing today. He was supposed to be nullifying Rebic, and he did that.
Jonathan, Calvin Phillips was excellent today. David Anderson in the Mirror was saying, I'm watching Italian TV's coverage and the commentator just called him the Yorkshire Pirlo in Italy. He was excellent, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. And I think the great thing he gives you, and it's the thing he's really developed under Bielsa, is he has that range of forward passing that when he gets the ball, his first instinct is to pass the ball forwards, which for players who play deep in midfield, that isn't always the case. And so he does add a bit of urgency to an England team that I think occasionally can lack that. And it also means if you are playing the two holding players, Rice, I think, is very good at driving forward. And Phillips has the instinct to pass forwards, and also was liberated today in a way I hadn't really seen him. And you know, that run he made for the goal was brilliant. It was a fantastic goal. And in fact, it starts with Sterling on the left, it's recycled all the way around the back. But it's Phillips' run and Sterling's run that makes it, and Walker's pass. It's just a really, really good goal.
Ian says, to what extent would Jonathan Wilson ascribe the England win to the effects of Marcelo Bielsa's coaching?
Well, he's maybe Phillips would have become a brilliant player anyway, but the fact is he has gone from being a player that I don't think we really thought about as being even a potential England player over the course of 2 or 3 years to being, you know, somebody who's absolutely worth his place in the squad and is man of the match in England's first game of the tournament. So, and it, you know, the fact he so obviously plays in the Bielsa way. I think, you have to give Bielsa credit for that.
And don't forget also Bielsa's influence on Pep Guardiola, Man City providing, four players in that team. And probably reverse, Kieran Trippier, the two players from the Man City Academy in that England team, which is surprising given it's often, obviously that's slightly before, you the timeline's slightly wrong there, but you know, we're supposed to look at literature in that way now, aren't we? The influence of rap music on Shakespeare. So I'm sure that Bielsa in some way reverse-engineered Trippier's development.
Well, it's a fair point, though, that Bielsa influenced Guardiola and also Pochettino. So if you add together the Tottenham and Manchester City players in that squad, plus the Leeds player, I think you get to 7.
Bielsa he influenced Lampard as well, didn't he? Really annoyed Lampard, which probably made him play Mount a bit more. I'm really going to play Mason Mount to show him.
But hang on, has Marcelo Bielsa influenced any Croatian players to not play very well in that game? I'm trying to think about it.
Well, I mean, I think Bielsa is clearly a genius and would have been at whatever he turned his hand to, and the fact that he hasn't tried to turn back time. I think that really affected Croatia today, that they are old and slow. And maybe if Bielsa had worked on a way of stopping the degeneration of cells, that could have been halted. So you see, in that regard, yes.
I did enjoy Ewan Murray's tweet. Surprised at the level of praise towards England. I thought that was desperately dull against a team who offered absolutely nothing. Is Ewan on tomorrow after the Scotland game? I hope so.
That is the question, though, isn't it? I mean, Croatia were really poor, and okay, perhaps that was because England defended very well through midfield, perhaps it's because Mings was so dominant, but there was a couple of spells where Croatia held the ball very well, but there was so little penetration to their passing. It's day three of the tournament. This could look absurd in a week, but we've already seen three sort of Western European powers quite comfortably beating Eastern European sides. So Belgium hammering Russia, Italy beating Turkey, and England, I think, beating Croatia, although not by the same margin, but beat them quite convincingly. So sort of three nations who are part of that process you've seen over the last 20 years of industrialising youth production. And there's just sort of a greater pace, a greater energy to the game. Now, okay, you look at that Turkey lineup, and eight or nine of them do play in Western Europe, but how long have they been there? To what extent are they still sort of, when they go back to Turkey, are they still playing the football they've learned in the academies? So I do wonder if you're seeing the benefits of that, the way that the wealthier Western European nations have taken youth development and industrialised it.
And how much Bielsa hates Eastern Europe, so has done nothing with anyone in Eastern Europe. You mentioned Tyrone Mings. Paul, he was brilliant today, and a lot of people, I think I'd put Ben White in the starting 11 because of recency bias, and thought he didn't play well in those two warm-up games. And however much or however little he was up against today, he did play incredibly well.
Yeah, he did. I mean, you know, I think one of the bigger questions about him in his performances, which again, you know, those two warm-up games are very difficult to make. One shouldn't draw any big conclusions from them because they're just there to get people warm. But, you know, it was his distribution, and I think that was still probably the weakest aspect of his game today. But in terms of his reading of play, his ability to put himself in the right position to make an interception and to make that interception using, you know, the strength and skill at his disposal, it was, you know, impressive and thoroughly consistent across the game. You know, he was incredibly reliable, and I think that just sort of really helped in the whole just setting the tone. I thought the interesting part of the game for me was after that first English rush of the first 20 minutes, which you would hope for, don't always get, but when you do, you're quite used to it burning out and then collapsing, and it burnt out. Croatia got on the ball. I think they might have had one half chance, but England just steadied themselves, and Mings was right at the centre of that. They weren't, you know, they got close together. There was no way through, and then gradually, just England recovered, and they recovered. You know, they were never shook at any point in the game, and you know, by the end of that first half, they were in control of possession again, playing at Croatia's pace, which I thought was very interesting.
I mean, can I just add that while we obviously have a lot of recency bias about recent things that have happened, England, to put a sort of counter spin, I mean, Tyrone Mings didn't really have much defending to do, which always makes you look better. And also, England did win this game without the attack actually playing very well. Harry Kane was... he had a real problem. He looked lethargic. And there was just so much space. You know, there's going to be this issue. We're going to have to go on about Harry Kane dropping deep, and like, what's he doing dropping deep? Why? Because there is a sort of congestion in that area, and while it makes sense for him to play those passes, that means you end up with Raheem Sterling getting England's best chances, whereas Harry Kane's absolutely lethal goal scorer. So that was a slight problem. Phil Foden, who is very, very left-footed, when you play him wide on that side, I think opponents will force him to go the way he doesn't want to go a bit, and that's something you have to develop. He looked pretty bright at the beginning. He didn't really do much. They did win without... If we're all about the attacking riches, those weren't really on display. Other teams won't be looking at that saying, oh, my God, they have a terrifying attack. And the final thing I'd like to say is there was a really nice bit at the end where the players did their little lap of honour, and were actually really, you could see they were really pleased to see the crowd, and they were waving at their families just down below us, and it was really nice, and you realised how young so many of those players are, like their mums were waving at them, who looked quite alarmingly young, and you just thought, what a nice bunch of people they are. It was a really nice moment. It made you feel like you were at a kind of, you know, when you play amateur football or you go to a non-league game and people are literally waving at their families after the game or when they come off, it kind of felt a bit like that. And I realised how many of them have been through the pyramid, how many of them this is the first tournament for. And you just thought, well, it's a nice team and they deserve to do well. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin did a thing where he was waving at a child. And you know when you make that face where you want the child to kind of grin back at you. And I was kind of right behind him and he was making this face for quite a long time. And it was just really, really strange. But I do admire his willingness and energy to keep that face going for so long. And it wasn't weird and freaky and disturbing at all.
You know, you realise you're not going to make it as a footballer, not when a footballer is younger than you. It's when a footballer's mum is younger than you. That's the real, that is the final nail in the coffin of our professional footballers' careers. You talk about the atmosphere. What was the moment like when they took the knee? I saw Jacob Steinberg tweeting that actually the applause really drowned out the small number of people who did it.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's not funny and there's nothing funny here, but the booing of the knee has now become a part of this ritual. It was like a really, it was expertly done. Everyone was like, yeah, okay, we kneel, you boo, they applaud. And it was like military precision. They kneeled, the boo came, the applause came. I felt like everyone was going to applaud themselves after and say, well done, good booing, good applause. You drowned us out. Wow, that was good. It was done very well. It was better than the actual opening ceremony bit. I thought it was slick, but there weren't many boos, and they seemed perfunctory rather than hate filled. Someone was making a stupid point and they made it, but I was heartened by the round of applause. I mean, basically the knee. It's such a ridiculous situation. I mean, taking the knee, I think if people hadn't started booing, it would probably have kind of just gone by now. Everyone knows it's a gesture. It was something happened in lockdown and it made people feel like doing something. It's basically saying stop abusing us on social media, and it's saying we support this idea and we're going to make a visible gesture, but it's not going to change anything. You know, it is, I understand Les Ferdinand's point about this is just a kind of hashtag thing, and fine, it wasn't meant to change the world, but then when you boo it, it becomes really significant and suddenly it's a big deal. And no, we're not going to stop doing it because booing it actually is powerful and political and, you know, it's got a lot of force behind it. So I don't know, maybe everyone could just, I guess what I'm saying, stop booing it is what I'm saying.
Can I, Wilson, ask you just briefly back on the pitch, the changes that Gareth Southgate made, were you surprised by them? Did you think they were the right ones? There's obviously, there's still a clamour. We've got lots of questions saying, I still think Jack Grealish should have played, for example, or should have come on.
The substitutions. Well, I thought taking Foden off Rashford, that was the first one, wasn't it? And I mean, that I think made sense because Foden had sort of, after that bright start, had faded out of the game. And I think it did make sense to look at having two quicker players, two players who would burst beyond Kane, given that there was just a sign Croatia might start to apply some pressure. So I think that did make complete sense. So the second one, Bellingham for Kane, I guess he just shored up the midfield a bit and Kane hadn't really been involved.
Bellingham for Kane is an amazing substitution if you think about it. They were 1-0 up with 9 minutes to go, something like that. Take the captain off and bring a 17-year-old on.
Absolutely. Yeah. It shows Southgate's great faith in him and also suggests how poorly Kane was playing. But what it then does is it means you've got your two runners as the two forwards and they can be sort of, they don't have to be central, they can find their own positions and it does giving them that opportunity on the break. My concern when that happened was that it was a little bit like the Colombia game of inviting pressure, but Croatia was so weak that it didn't really matter, and maybe it would have worked anyway. I don't know, maybe it was the right thing to do, but it was just that little bit of concern when that happened. And then bringing Calvert-Lewin on, well, you know, last minute, you know, just somebody to hold the ball up, and Sterling was probably knackered after 90 minutes of running about in the heat, and yeah, it seemed reasonable enough.
Jude Bellingham becomes the youngest ever player to appear in the European Championship finals for any nation. The youngest English player in any major tournament, 17 years, 349 days. His mum is 35 years old and 207 days. That, I don't have that fact to hand. That's just a guess. Ange Postecoglou Facts says, how well did you rate Croatia helping Harry Kane passing on the captain's armband to speed up the game chasing down the equaliser? I enjoyed that bit a great deal. Kane did look slightly miffed when he came off.
But that was the most urgency Croatia showed in the entire game.
You're probably right. Callum says, after Jesse Lingard took a parrot to watch the match, what unusual animal would you take to watch a football match? It was really great to see Jesse Lingard. It must be very disappointing to be, you know, dropped at the squad at the last minute. He must have been very close to getting into that squad.
And so he took a parrot?
He went to watch the game in a beer garden with a Declan Rice England shirt on, and he had a parrot on his shoulder.
A live parrot?
A live parrot, yes.
It'll be the pub parrot, probably, rather than Jesse's parrot, wouldn't it?
I don't think Jesse owns a parrot, but how many pubs have parrots?
Oh, the King's Arms in Sunderland used to have a parrot. Peter, it was called, yeah. No, it was very solid. It was grey.
Oh, it was sullen, was it?
It was very sullen.
It's not a surprise.
And it really hated bald men.
Was that an issue in sullen grey parrot who hated bald men in Sunderland?
It would just attack bald men in the pub. It was the problem was that kind of during the week the pub was quite quiet, so the parrot just sat on the cage and it was fine. Mm-hmm. Saturday lunchtimes before a match, when it gets crowded, it then got annoyed with people in its space and it had to be locked back in the cage, and it didn't enjoy that at all.
As a result, did fewer bald? Was it a very hirsute pub as a result? Because
it didn't last very long. The parrot, because it flew out the door one day and never came.
Killed
back.
By a bald man, I presume.
Can I just say, I'd like to go and watch a game with one of Pablo Escobar's cocaine hippos.
Absolutely right.
Well, the 1937 FA Cup final, there was a 12-year-old boy took a black kitten. To watch Sunderland beat Preston 3-1.
No place for a kitten.
Well, smuggled it in his overcoat pocket, because it's got Sunderland's nickname, the Black Cat. A lot of people think it's a modern affectation. It actually dates back to the 1890s. And so this kitten and the boy became briefly famous in Sunderland.
I don't think, Paul, you've thought it through in that getting to the game would be difficult.
Well, with the cocaine hippo.
Of animal. Yes, unless you meet it there.
It would run at such a clip. You'd saddle it up, it would be there. It would probably get there faster. It would evade traffic.
Yeah, the turnstile would
be low enough
be
to
an
go
issue.
Under the barriers. And nobody would mess with you. If you saw anybody booing, if somebody was responding to something deep inside themselves, which they had not resolved, in response to a barely political gesture, then that hippo would be able to act. On your behalf.
Hippos do kill a lot of people, don't they?
They do, yeah. They still are. These cocaine hippos impressive. Are still breeding and killing.
We should probably end part one, shouldn't we? We've got football to talk about. We'll do that in a second. We'll talk about Austria 3, North Macedonia 1. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. A reminder, you can vote for Football Weekly in the Listener's Choice Award of the British Podcast Awards. What you have to do is go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and search for Football Weekly. So if everybody listening could do that, we may win, and then we'll talk about it a lot. And as we've already discussed, we will share the pod equally amongst everybody, with Ed Ahrens getting first go because his surname has two A's at the beginning. Unless, of course, the Aardvark family in Nova Scotia our listeners. Austria 3, North Macedonia 1. Austria's first win at the Euros at their seventh attempt. Their first victory at a major tournament since the 1990 World Cup. Richard Jolly has some stats from this game. The only group game in Euro 2020 between two landlocked countries. A big game for everyone who hates coastline. Before we talk about Goran Pandev, which was a wonderful story, the second goal, which was most important for Austria, Wilson, was a cross from David Alaba, who I'm sure was playing in the middle of a three. I don't know what he was doing. He seems to play everywhere, Alaba. It's extraordinary.
Yes. Had there been a set play that had been partially cleared? Because there was a lot of players in the box. I think that's how it had come about. But the delivery for both the first two goals, the Sabitzer's delivery for the first goal and Alaba's for the second, was excellent. So it was a slightly odd game that kind of... At first I thought Austria were going to walk it. Then they gift North Macedonia the goal. And then the game falls into this lull. And I sort of was thinking, oh, this is a terrible game of football. But then it actually really picked up the last half hour. And Austria, without being brilliant, you know, the three goals they scored were all very nice goals. And they clearly do have enough about them that they can be dangerous to sides.
First goal, Paul, from Stefan Leiner. Goal of the tournament so far?
Yeah. And on the Alaba point, I heard Emma Hayes, who I thought was excellent in punditry, wrote an excellent column this morning about Southgate's England team as well. Obviously, shame she's got an important day job because she's a very good pundit. It was suggesting that Alaba was playing on the left of the back three in the second half, which might have made made a difference.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I mean, Sabitzer's a quality player. I've seen him play once in the flesh for Leipzig and got a great engine, great tackle, but obviously a great range of distribution as well. And that was a pinpoint cross. One of those... Can you say Van Basten-esque for that sort of finish from that sort of angle? I don't know.
No.
The commentator mentioned Van Basten. You can't, because it's...
It's just not like
he's
it.
Done brilliant.
It's a tight angle on the inside of your right foot. But I mean, it was pretty close to the goal.
No, but Van Basten is further away, and the ball is dropping to him, and he has to generate the pace with the swing of his boot, whereas Leiner sort of just guides it. The pace is on the cross.
to people who can't see the video, I'm holding my hands up, admitting defeat in this point.
The skill of Leiner actually is when in midair to actually sort of move your foot forwards with power. I thought that was the...
Yeah, but I don't think he has to really have a swing at it. It's a controlled finish because all the pace is on the ball. So that makes it different to Van Basten. Yeah, but it's a great finish because he has to get the height. He has to sort of hang up there for, I mean, I was going to say a couple of seconds, clearly not a couple of seconds, less than a couple of seconds, but sufficient time to reach the ball and guide it in.
Barney, I'm not really coming to you in this game because you were on the way home from Wembley. Just so you don't feel left out, or listeners don't think, you decided not to talk for this part. You are playing with the toy that you were given at Wembley, though.
Yeah, it's just something from the goodie bag.
What'd you get?
A water bottle,
mm-hmm.
which is nice. A plug thing, which is nice.
Okay.
And this weird kind of mascot person. Does the word Alipay have some significance? Is that a sponsor? It seemed to...
Yeah. It's a Chinese online payment mechanism.
Okay. Well, it worked once and now it's sort of died. Sorry, Alipay. I'm sure your products are really good.
Could you describe it for us, please?
It's kind of a one-eyed football, a lovable football imp, a kind of alien child sitting on top of a football windmill, picking out in a red light the words Alipay, but only very briefly before it tragically dies forever. And is gone. But it was a nice moment.
It was lovely. Marko Arnautovic, Paul, seemed slightly angry about the whole game. When he scored a goal. He didn't start. Perhaps that was it. But it was Tamuri Ketsbaya levels, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I think the thing with him, remembering him from his glory days at West Ham, is like, you do like him when he's angry. That's when he tends to deliver his... It's when he's diffident and can't be asked that he's a problem. But he came on, made a cute 1-2, drifted inside, sent the keeper, tucked away the goal, went Ketsbaya, got really, really angry. And then David Alaba, there's that sort of like primate kind of language thing about like who touches who or what part of the body and how it signifies primacy. And how in the photo with Joe Biden and Boris Johnson this weekend, it's Biden who's got his arm around Johnson, making Johnson the junior partner in the relationship. Well, Alaba comes over and grabs him by the jaw. He's in the middle of ranting against the world, just grabs him by the jaw and goes, he's ostensibly congratulating him, saying, well done, big man. But essentially what he's saying is, don't forget, you're number two to me. I'm the main one, you're the second one, and you're doing all right by scoring that goal. So I thought it was a very cute moment.
Goran Pandev's goal was a great moment for North Macedonia. Colin Miller, stat, he'd already scored two international goals before Jude Bellingham was born. this is Richard Jolly's. He making his debut 7,312 days after his debut in international football, his major tournament debut. The second oldest player ever to score at the Euros after Austria's Evika Vastic versus Poland in 2008. Palermo have had 51 managerial reigns, not all Francesco Guidolin, in the time between Goran Pandev's North Macedonia debut and his first appearance at a major tournament. Pandev has faced David Seaman in international football. David Seaman will be 58 in September. What a story, Wilson.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. Because he's obviously been, he's carried that team for 20 years. And the goal was ridiculous. I mean, it was... I can't remember the last goal I saw as daft as that. So it's sort of an aimless punt forward. Hinteregger, for no good reason, goes for it with the outside of his left foot rather than just swinging his right foot through it. I mean, the good reason probably is he doesn't trust his right foot. smacks it into the face of a retreating midfielder. It bounces through. The keeper comes out for it, has all the time in the world to get there, but sort of does what Van Breukelen did against Ireland in 1990 and somehow just sort of collides with the defender and pushes it into the path of Pandev, who then, to be fair to him, takes it really nicely because he has to sort of step between a grounded centre-forward and a grounded defender and sort of dink the finish over the grounded defender. But it's just a farcical goal. I mean, the goal that genuinely made me laugh when I saw it, and then I laughed even more on the replay.
You weren't having the Austrian kit, though, Wilson.
Well, it's actually one of those things that I sort of made a cheap gag about, and then it turns out it's quite serious. I just thought it looked rubbish, like the black shirt with the sort of, officially it's teal, the shorts. And the reason that is given, if you follow it on the Pima website, is it's carrying on the design of their last away kit. The last away kit sort of had, I don't know, they looked like peacock feathers, like in teal on a black background. And that apparently was to represent the Art Nouveau designs of popular in Vienna in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And the teal colour is the oxidized copper of the, you know, the domes in Vienna. But it, coincidentally, these black and teal are the colours of the ÖVP, the right-wing ruling party of Austria. But then as I was criticising that, I realised England have just changed their away kit to Tory blue. So maybe we're not in a position to judge.
Is it the same blue? It's a slightly different blue. Can't snowflake liberal lefties like me see it as a slightly different blue?
It just should be red. It's an England away kit.
That's a very good point. Yeah, it's a very good point you make. That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll talk about the Netherlands 3, Ukraine 2, game of the tournament. What's it doing so far down the running order? I blame producer Ian. We'll do that in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. I should say that we recorded parts one and two of the pod before the Netherlands-Ukraine game. We weren't to know it was going to be this good. James says, do good games happen because of Ali McCoist, or does Ali McCoist happen because of good games? He was doing the commentary with Clive Tilsley in the UK. Sam says, this is like watching Leeds versus Leeds. Wilson, this was great fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, huge amount of fun. I think the Dutch looked the better side, and for a long time, better than I'd expected them to be. But Ukraine were certainly in the first half were dangerous on the break. I think that first sort of 25 minutes of the second half, Ukraine, for whatever reason, just sort of their level dropped. And the game sort of looked over, and then suddenly Yarmolenko scores that brilliant goal, and they're back in it, and it's a really rousing finish. So, yeah, it was hugely enjoyable.
Bushan Paul made brilliant saves in the first half. I sort of felt sorry for him because he was unlucky with the first goal, I guess, because you can parry it out to anyone. The second, it was very close to him. And the third, he probably could have done better. But the difference in the two halves is quite stark for him.
Yeah, I mean, that save on the Wijnaldum shot in the first half where it took that, it was going at real pace and took a deflection. It was reminiscent of Kasper Schmeichel in the cup final. It was a really great save. But I felt the first he wasn't decisive. The second one, the second one he got bullied a bit. And then the third one, you know, there's some criminal decision making. He should have booted the ball long clear, tried to pass it out. And then he was caught flat footed with the header, which, you know, was actually, I mean, it was about a yard inside the post. So he could have saved that too. So I think you could probably look at him for all of the, being involved in a negative way in all of the goals, unfortunately. And that was a shame because, you know, Ukraine had pulled out two pearlers really to come back into the match.
Barney, this felt very, we're in the summer watching a tournament to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's nice to see a fun tournament game with a few mistakes and, you know, a little bit open and people holding their head in their hands and people pulling out. I mean, even the Wijnaldum finish was so nice, wasn't it? It was just this broken moment. I mean, it came from a good bit of play on the right, and the goalkeeper had a very quick decision to make about where to put the ball. But the way he didn't break stride, just put it into the top corner, it's the sort of thing you do in the warm-up in Sunday League. Like, you can do that in the warm-up, but to do in a match was, you know, he's obviously just such a quality player, isn't he? In ways we haven't always seen for Liverpool with Holland as well. But I agree, a slightly broken game with a bit of defensive raggedness, but some good play. That's what tournaments are all about, isn't it?
Wijnaldum plays a slightly different role, doesn't he, Wilson, for the Netherlands?
I sort of know what you mean, but I'm not never quite sure what his role for Liverpool is. He just seems to be one of those players who can do anything in midfield. So I think his role at Liverpool is pretty flexible. Or it was. I mean, obviously he's now left, but he's clearly the sort of central hub of that Dutch team in a way that, you know, he just never was at Liverpool.
And De Jong as well with him. This is very niche, and I don't think it will mean anything to you, but every time I hear Frenkie de Jong is one of those players that you have to use his full name. You can't just say De Jong. You have to say Frenkie de Jong. And it just reminds me of a very strange put-together band called Only the Young from X Factor. I don't know, I think about 2014. So I just kept thinking of this very... They would go on X Factor and sing like songs from the Jungle Book. And it's only for me. Please somebody get in touch and say I'm not the only one who thinks of that. Yarmolenko, I mean, there are players, Barney, who just cut inside on their left foot and do things. You know, the Arjen Robben is, I suspect, Yarmolenko is what, two-thirds of an Arjen Robben as a footballer or less?
Well, that goal was a brilliant goal, but he has... someone who watches West Ham much more than I do would know, but there was a carbon copy goal, wasn't there? And it's amazing the way he hits the ball on the run there. That technique is amazing. It almost looks as though he's hitting with his weaker foot. You know, when you kick with your weaker foot, there's a very deliberate kind of movement you do. And it kind of looks like that, but it's obviously not his weaker foot. And it was completely unsavable. This is impossible to say because it dipped and curled from outside the goal. It was amazing. But... there was an identical goal, wasn't there? Someone's going to say what it is now.
Manchester United?
Was it Man United?
Against Manchester United, I think, yeah.
I feel like he does it sort of once every 4 months and then goes back to bed.
Yeah.
You know, like hibernate.
He's sort of like the opposite of Timo Werner, right? So Timo Werner is really good at all bits of football, apart from kicking the ball in the net. And Yarmolenko seems like he can't really be bothered with football, apart from occasionally scoring brilliant goals. But his record for Ukraine is incredible. Is that 39 for Ukraine?
No, 41.
41, which I think it was only Shevchenko scored more than him. Which, having seen him be very sporadically kind of good at West Ham, you sort of wonder how he's managed that level of consistency at international level.
Do you remember in Ukraine, you were there as well, weren't you? The England game in 2012, he was the kind of coming man then. I remember, you know, this is our kind of hope.
Well, he was always talked of as in a pair with Conor Plianka, wasn't he?
That's right.
Yeah, they never came as a one. Conor Plianka's in the squad, isn't he? But just injured again.
I can't envisage a time where Yarmolenko was young and up and coming as a footballer. He's always been gnarled and 33 to me. While I was watching the game, I was obviously on Twitter, and that second goal, I wasn't sure it was offside or not because it looked quite tight. And then I noticed that the former leader of the Lib Dems, Tim Farron, seemed to be doing an MBM on this game. I think that was offside. Dumfries was surely interfering with play. I'm not sure that was what VAR was checking. Anyhow, 2-0 it is. And he did. I mean, if you go through Tim Farron's whole Twitter, he's done most of the game. This reminds me of Brazil-Italy in 82. Neither side deserves to lose, he says.
Which one was Tim Farron? Was he the slightly... kind of like a really fun geography teacher sort of guy who...
Staunch Christian beliefs.
Oh, yeah.
That was it. There was something about God.
That goal, sorry, I just... That shot takes a very slight deflection as soon as he hits it. That's why it goes in, right? I completely accept the point about the keeper being at fault for the first and third, but that one, I'm not really sure he could have done much more because it does... You know, he sets himself for the shot, and it gets a very slight deflection immediately, which sort of causes it to sort of spin down and bounce up. I've been on WhatsApp trying to defend the keeper because I've been praising him so much in the first half, and obviously you do that on a WhatsApp group and he makes a mistake, so everybody starts hammering you. So the first goal, I'm tempted to blame Mikhailenko, who had a shocking night against Dumfries on the Ukrainian left. Dumfries had the beating of him all the time, and so I think he had to go for that, and it was difficult, and the
just pushed out in the wrong place. But then,
who's in the WhatsApp group where you're defending Ukrainian goalkeepers?
Ken Early from...
Okay. Oh, that's good company. That's just a WhatsApp conversation, right?
Yeah, sorry, I'm overstating the number of friends I have, quite right.
Richard Jolly writing, the first day, two historic Scottish places have both scored in the European Championships with Sterling and Dumfries. Is Denzel Dumfries, that's the best name of any player in this tournament, isn't it? No one's got a better name than Denzel Dumfries.
If any name that makes you think of Denzel Washington is all right by me.
Well, Memphis Depay is pretty good.
How good are the Netherlands then, Barney? I don't really know after that.
No, I mean, there was a lot of talk on the telly about... Actually, and Gary Neville was right to say that, they'll get caught out at some point, he said at half-time, and he was immediately proved right in that half. They're obviously trying to play a system they haven't quite sort of had time or the ability to groove. So I think that they'll be fun, and that's a good thing, and I will look forward to watching them.
Before we go... Just to update you on Christian Eriksen, Troels Henriksen has written a piece in The Guardian, which is really worth reading about sort of what Christian Eriksen means to Danish people. Earlier today, the team doctor, Martin Burson, confirmed that Christian Eriksen had suffered a cardiac arrest. He said, "How close were we to losing him? I don't know, but we got him back after one defibrillation, so that's quite fast. The examinations that have been done so far look fine. We don't have an explanation as to why it happened. This morning we spoke to Christian, who sent his greetings to his teammates. We'd like to thank everyone for their heartfelt greetings." The head coach, Kasper Hjulmand, said Eriksen told him he did not remember much from the game. He quoted the midfielder saying, "Though I think you're feeling worse than I am. I feel as if I'm about to go training now, boys." So it's good that he's in high spirits. Wilson, we were quite critical yesterday of UEFA for giving Denmark just two options, whether the players should go straight back out or play the next day. But were we perhaps slightly unfair?
Well, I don't know how UEFA couched it, but certainly, I was virtually doing the press conference with Hjulmand, and he really didn't, he was very much stressing there was no pressure placed on us. And he said that UEFA said, "Look, the two options really are you play tonight, or because Finland have a game on the 16th and Denmark on the 17th, the only other time we could really play is Monday." And Hjulmand said that, he went to the players and was sort of, and he kept stressing, said, "You have to dare to say what you actually think. And if you don't want to play, you have to say you don't want to play. And that's fine. If you want to play, that's fine. If you want to come back tomorrow, that's fine." And he said the consensus was that none of the players want to go away, so no, they wouldn't sleep, that they'd be dwelling on it, and then have to get on the bus next morning, come back and do it again. So the phrase he used was "get it over with." I don't know if that's a translation issue. I don't know if that means in the original Danish what it sounds like it means in English. But he was definitely stressing that nobody had been coerced, and he was making clear he'd have been perfectly... if a player said he didn't want to play, then he wouldn't have played. And Simon Kerr came off very quickly because he didn't feel he could do it. And Kerr obviously was at the forefront of everything, both as the captain and he was the first person to Eriksen, sort of helped get him in the right position, and then was obviously comforting Eriksen's wife. So... who knows how UEFA put that to them, but certainly my impression from watching that press conference was that Hjulmand didn't feel he was any pressure being placed on him.
Okay, it's interesting. We got an incredible response to yesterday's pod, and I wanted to thank everybody for getting in touch. Feel slightly self-indulgent to read out a couple of messages, especially ones that really praise Barry, which feels completely wrong in so many ways, especially those who came to the live show to know what he was talking about on on Thursday night, Wilson. But look, Claire said, "I just listened. I let all the tears I'd been holding back in shock flow. Thank you, Joseph. I did cry in the bath. You did well yesterday. Paul, you guys were great, responsible for me being in tears in the frozen section in Tesco's earlier." Jim sent us an email, footballweekly@theguardian.com, saying, "It's sometimes said that of all the things that don't matter in life, football is the best thing. Over the last year, and particularly last night, the show's been the embodiment of that. In true abnormal situations, you've always managed to strike the right tone between seriousness and levity, offering a support network, friendship, an arm around the shoulder, a reassuring voice, all these things and more. To Christian, I send my best wishes. To the Football Weekly team, I say thank you." the Norwegian professional ski jumper, Halvor Granerud, who sent this to Lars, obviously all of Lars's friends are ski jumpers, you'd expect so, said, I think the importance of people in the spotlight daring to show emotion and show vulnerability is incredibly important. There are probably many who recognise that in what you spoke about. The focus should be on the importance of sharing feelings and the importance of someone you look up to or feel you know, feel the same things that thousands of listeners felt yesterday, and that belonging is worth its weight in gold. And I'll do one more from Jen, who says, Dear Max, Barry, Lars and Philippe, thank you for today's beautiful pod. I'm in Sydney. I woke up to the news. I can't imagine what it would have been like to experience it in real time. I cried along with you as I listened to you recount it. I'm hoping that Christian Eriksen makes a swift and full recovery. I'm grateful to have you in my ears in the meantime. P.S. I am the 32-year-old Spurs fan who a few months ago suggested you send Barry down under for love. Please know that the offer still stands. Does anybody have any words to suggest that Jen should reconsider us sending Barry to Australia?
I mean, if she still thinks that having listened to the live show, then my goodness.
I think you can still download the live show, Jen. And this is not a way to make you part with £7. That would seem a rude thing to do. But I would do that. And if you're still considering it, we will box him up and FedEx him to you. If you want to get in touch on the email, you can, of course, footballweekly@theguardian.com. We'll be back tomorrow. Spain, Sweden, Poland, Slovakia, Scotland, Czech Republic. But for today's pod, Paul McInnes, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Barney.
Cheers. Bye, everyone.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.